We all know the world of energy and natural resources is changing fast. People are demanding action on the climate crisis. Businesses and politicians are throwing their weight behind the energy transition. And technology is reshaping the world as we know it. But we must ensure the result doesn't become too complex and too confusing. That's where the Climate Transition Podcast comes in. In this series, DLA Piper's Energy and Natural Resources team speaks to special guests to help you make sense of it all. My name is Natasha Luther-Jones. I'm the Global Co-Chair of the Energy and Natural Resources sector here at DLA Piper. I'm also co-head of our International Sustainability and ESG offering. And I am your host for the series.
Today we ask, will U.S. tax credits unleash growth of green hydrogen? I'm Lindsay McLeod, a partner at DLA Piper in the energy practice, and I'll be your host for this episode. Green hydrogen plays an interesting role in the global energy mix. It's a technology with huge potential to help decarbonize sectors that depend on fossil fuels, including transportation and heavy industry. But current production capacity is limited. This is why policymakers around the world are seeking to provide financial incentives that can unlock production. In the U.S., the federal government announced in August of 2022 in the Inflation Reduction Act that it would offer tax credits to help the green hydrogen industry. But the industry had a long wait until the U.S. Treasury and IRS spelled out further details of what this means in late December of 2023. In this episode, we explore the details of those rules and look at how they could potentially affect new projects. Do they strike the right balance or are they too strict? How do they compare to similar rules in Europe? And how fast can we expect U.S. green hydrogen to grow now that we have further clarity? These are some big questions, and that's why I'm joined by a special guest who can help me answer all of these and more. Jason Evans is a senior director of energy at 12, which uses green hydrogen in combination with its own proprietary carbon transformation technology to make low-carbon e-jet fuel. Previously, he's worked for firms including EdgeCore Digital Infrastructure and Amazon Web Services, where I had the privilege of working with him. Hi, Jason. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Lindsay.
Okay, I'm gonna start it off easy. Can you tell us what 12 does and how it relates to the green hydrogen industry?
For sure. So just like you said, 12 is a technology company that has a proprietary carbon dioxide electrolyzer that takes carbon dioxide and transforms it into carbon monoxide. So then that carbon monoxide can then be used to create fuels and materials that are effectively made from air instead of oil. One of the products that we're most excited about is our e-jet aviation fuel. So this is a fossil-free, power-to-liquid, sustainable aviation fuel. And the inputs are carbon dioxide, water, and renewable energy. So we leverage our carbon dioxide electrolyzers alongside water-to-hydrogen electrolyzers to produce this sustainable aviation fuel. And in this process, as you can tell, green hydrogen is a really key ingredient. And so we've been working on facilities where we can both own those hydrogen electrolyzers and create our own green hydrogen, or partner with green hydrogen developers where we purchase that green hydrogen.
So clearly you have a very cool job, but what were you doing before you joined 12?
So I started in the energy industry in 2008. I ended up co-founding a solar development company. We were very early in the solar industry when the largest project in the U.S. was about 14 megawatts. And we ended up working on utility scale solar projects from California to Massachusetts. In 2019, I moved over to the buyer side and joined you at Amazon. And I worked there on renewable procurement, making sure that Amazon could meet its climate pledge goals, as well as its broader energy strategy for where to site data centers across the U.S. and across the Americas. Most recently, I've moved over to a data center developer where I was leading the energy vertical, again, doing the energy strategy part, as well as making sure that our renewable goals were fulfilled. And so I get to combine those experiences now at 12 and help them to build really large, fully renewable loads and help to bring those online.
Well, I'll just say from firsthand experience working with you that 12 is incredibly lucky to have you. So diving into today's discussion, as you already know, Jason, on December 22nd, the Treasury Department and IRS published proposed regulations regarding the Production Tax Credit, or PTC, for hydrogen under Section 45V of the Internal Revenue Code as enacted by the Inflation Reduction Act. Under Section 45V, a PTC is available for each kilogram of clean hydrogen produced during the taxable year for the first 10 years after the hydrogen generation facility is placed into service. Alternatively, taxpayers can elect to claim an investment tax credit under Section 48 based on the investment in the hydrogen production facility. The Section 45V credit equals $3 per kilogram of hydrogen produced multiplied by the applicable rate, which is basically just based on the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions rate of the hydrogen that's produced. This $3 per kilogram amount is reduced to 60 cents per kilogram if the prevailing wage and apprenticeship requirements are not satisfied. And to be eligible for the Section 45V credit, construction of the facility must begin prior to 2033. This PTC may be used by the taxpayer, sold to an unrelated party, or claimed as a refund under the direct pay rules. That was a tax mouthful, but one controversial part of the proposed regulations is how they set the standards for the maximum credit by basically adding three requirements. Can you tell us more about those three requirements?
Yeah, for sure. And the Treasury guidance, like you said, is really focused on understanding what is the carbon impact for producing this hydrogen using electrolyzers. And so since this hydrogen is being produced with electricity, it really comes down to understanding what is the carbon impact of that electricity production. In other words, is it being produced with renewable or carbon-free electricity? And the standard way you make sure that the electricity you're using is renewable is using environmental attributes, typically RECs. And so what we're used to is in the greenhouse gas protocol, when we're talking about corporate customers making their electricity renewable, and they have to purchase RECs from renewable power plants producing renewable electricity, and then apply those to their electricity usage. And there are fairly few limitations on what those RECs have to satisfy in order to be used in that context. Treasury's draft guidance, though, lays out these, like you said, really stringent criteria around what RECs are going to count to make hydrogen electricity, the electricity used to make that hydrogen renewable. So the first one of them is regionality, which means that the renewable energy project that you're using for RECs needs to be in the same grid as the hydrogen facility. And this looks a lot like the grids that we're used to when we're procuring renewable energy. It's the PJM, SPP, ERCOTs of the world, where as long as it's in that same regional grid, it'll count. Then there's additionality, which means that the renewable energy project that you're purchasing RECs from has to have come online no earlier than 3 years before your hydrogen facility begins operating. So these need to be new projects coming onto the grid. And then finally, the criteria that everybody is most focused on is time matching. And we're used to scenarios where RECs have to be produced in the same year as our consumption. But Treasury has gone a step further and said, actually, the renewable energy credits that you're relying on have to be produced in the same hour that you're consuming power. And so hour by hour, you need to match every single megawatt hour that you're consuming with a REC. Now, there's talk of allowing some resources that don't meet the three pillars, like existing hydro or nuclear, but those pathways just haven't been defined yet. And so we're first processing this guidance, figuring out what these three criteria are going to mean for the way we procure energy. And then hopefully we're going to see additional guidance in the next few quarters that'll lay out what's going to happen with the existing resources that we'd also like to rely on.
So it sounds like you are still processing what this might mean, but can you give me kind of an early preview? How do you expect the rules are going to impact your procurement strategy?
So our procurement strategy is going to change pretty dramatically based on the guidance from the IRS. We're looking at matching what are typically going to be intermittent resources, solar, wind, with our hydrogen production now. And our hydrogen production ideally is 24/7 production. You have to remember that these are really large capital investments that go into purchasing these electrolyzers. And with that large capital investment, we want to make sure that these electrolyzers are kept running as much as possible. And so we want to do this 24/7 every day. And so as a result, to hourly match that production, we need to go out into the market and procure solar and wind that ideally are perfectly complementary. We get the solar in the daytime, wind at night. And if we were able to find that perfect resource that had those profiles every day, then we'd be able to hourly match our production. But unfortunately, as you know, solar and wind varies. We'll have bad solar days, we'll have bad solar years. And so hourly matching becomes an incredibly difficult challenge with the reality of how these resources produce power. We're theoretically going to have to over-procure in the market. And that means that we're going to go into the same market that we're developing our hydrogen electrolyzers, and we're going to not procure the same number of megawatt hours from solar and wind, but we're going to far over-procure from solar and wind, hundreds of megawatts of solar, hundreds of megawatts of wind, in order to make sure that even in those bad years, we have enough power every hour of every day to match the production that we want to get out of our hydrogen electrolyzer. In addition, operationally, it becomes a really big challenge. And we're going to need to be predicting for the next day, what is that production going to look like from our solar and wind projects, so that we can then adjust our hydrogen electrolyzer production capacity for that next day. And then we're going to need to do that on an hour by hour basis. If clouds come across our solar project, we're going to need to lower our hydrogen electrolyzer production. So this is going to be an incredibly challenging operational procedure to put in place to make sure that we are marrying all these sources of information, whether it's weather forecasts, whether it's real-time production, whether it's our own electrolyzer capacity. We just need to marry all of these to make sure that we're not violating the Treasury rules with regards to how we make sure that these are really green hydrogen molecules. And this is completely novel. Nobody's done this real-time matching of intermittent resources with your own load.
What about storage? How does that, right? So I'm thinking, like, how does storage come into play? Is that something that you guys could potentially utilize or no?
So storage is absolutely something that we could utilize, and is great because, unlike electrolyzers and unlike some of the chemical processes that I'll talk about in a moment, where there is some lag involved in adjusting our consumption, storage is relatively instantaneous. You can flip that switch and start charging a battery and discharging it immediately upon learning that, for example, your solar facility has gone offline, or if it's producing excess, you can store it. Unfortunately, the Treasury guidance doesn't give you a lot of detail about how that storage is going to be used exactly, whether it needs to be at the site of your hydrogen electrolyzer plant, whether it needs to be co-located with the solar plant, whether it could be at a distance from both of those. We just don't know yet what role storage is going to play.
Fair enough.
And so as I think about our procurement strategy, I see a lot of sophisticated work going on in the smart metering, dispatching, tracking to enable this hourly matching. And it's going to require a bunch of coordination between utilities, standards making bodies. We have controls manufacturers, RTOs. So all of these are going to need to be coordinating. And we don't anticipate that that's going to be a very fast process to line up all of those standards. And I think the other thing worth mentioning is that this is an even harder problem because of the way the Treasury is evaluating the production from these facilities. Right now, the way Treasury is defining green hydrogen is at a facility-wide level. And so over the year, applying the Treasury's current guidance, if you hourly match 98% of the time, which would be quite the feat, you've managed to line up your production with the production of renewable facilities 98% of the time, you would get the full tax credit, that $3 you referred to before. But if you miss just a couple more hours and drop down to 97% hourly matching, you can lose all of a sudden 66% of the PTC, drop from $3 down to a dollar. And so for a production tax credit, you end up with this all or nothing approach, which creates really massive cliff risks for financiers who are going to be looking at these projects. Finally, I just also want to mention that Treasury may have been thinking that it would work for hydrogen projects to operate intermittently. And in some situations, it will. I think there are two problems with this, though. First, the capital expense that I referenced before is really big for these hydrogen electrolyzers. And so you want these to be running all the time. It's hard to make the investments work operating these at a lower capacity factor. But I think it has an even bigger downstream impact on companies like ours that then use that hydrogen in a subsequent chemical process, in our case, to make aviation fuel. And that downstream chemical process is a typical chemical process that relies on continuous chemical processing. You have substrates that need to be kept at a very constant temperature. And so you really want continuous production of hydrogen in order to make that process run efficiently. And hydrogen storage, which is one way you might think about circumventing this intermittent hydrogen production, is still really expensive and space consuming. And so I think the treasury rules end up really impacting the downstream consumers of hydrogen more than they might have expected.
So what could the federal government do here to help you or to provide more clarity? Like what would make this less painful for you?
I think the biggest thing is understanding how the IRS is ultimately going to handle existing carbon-free resources. They hinted in the guidance that there's going to be some path for carbon-free resources. And I think there's really good logic to allow some of those existing resources to qualify for producing green hydrogen. In some cases, for example, clean energy laws in states require that all new generation has to be clean. And so even if a green hydrogen producer is using the existing clean generation, the overall grid is going to continue to become more and more green as more generators come online. It's not going to cause more fossil fuel generators to come online. In other locations, you have wind and solar that's getting curtailed because there's not enough transmission to bring it to load. And so here's another situation where siting a hydrogen electrolyzer near that curtailed energy will just result in more efficient use of that energy. It won't result in more fossil generation. We think that rather than engaging in each of these fact-specific analyses, it would be great for the Treasury to come out with a large-scale carve-out for existing generators across the board, somewhere between 5 and 10%. We think 10% is the right number for that carve out. And that's going to do a couple things. First, it's going to allow those existing nuclear and hydro facilities to be able to be used to produce green hydrogen. It's going to really boost the industry in that way. But it's also going to allow all the existing wind and solar projects to provide their hourly RECs into what I think is going to be a robust hourly REC market, where people are going to be trading RECs based on when they have overproduction. They can trade that REC with another person who is underproduced with their own resources. And so providing more RECs into that market is going to be really beneficial.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I know that 12 is also looking at the European market. How do the rules in the US compare to similar incentives in Europe?
So the European market takes a much more demand-driven approach than the supply-driven regulation in the US, meaning that Europe is looking at incentivizing airlines and other large shippers to use renewable fuels. They're requiring that at least 2% of those fuels come from renewable sources. And in Europe, they make that requirement, and then their requirement for how renewable fuels get produced looks very similar to the requirements in the US that allow a green hydrogen producer to qualify for the production tax credit. But there are a few key differences that I think the US should pay attention to. First, in Europe, they recognize the importance of existing resources and how those can be proof that carbon-free electricity is being used to produce the renewable fuels. For example, they say that electricity from the grid can meet the renewable requirement if the average renewable share is greater than 90%, or if there's curtailment, or if hourly pricing falls below $20 a megawatt hour. They say, okay, in all of these situations, we will expect that that renewables are dominating the grid, and therefore any electricity you consume is renewable. They also give you a longer timeline to get to hourly matching. All of the concerns that I have around the US being able to effectively create an hourly market in the next 4 years by 2028, those are somewhat addressed by the European standard, which gives you until 2030 to get to hourly matching. And then finally, I think the European market does it right in looking at green hydrogen and other renewable fuel production on a kilogram by kilogram or gallon by gallon basis. So you can have one facility that produces both clean fuels and non-renewable fuels. For those times when renewable energy isn't available, you can still make fuel, but it won't be counted as a renewable fuel according to their standards.
So it seems like we can potentially learn some things from our European friends. But back in the US, how do you envision the green hydrogen market changing now that we have these regulations?
So I think there are three impacts that I'm thinking about right now. One of them is just location. I mean, you're going to see the solar only markets that have thrived producing a lot of renewables. I'm thinking of California, Arizona, Nevada, these places that have seen a lot of penetration of solar. Those are relatively speaking less attractive in this situation because you don't have complementary resources that allow you to get those high capacity factors for your hydrogen production. And as a result, I think you're going to see a shift to those places that have great onshore wind production a lot through the middle of the country where you can get those resources that give you really good capacity factors when combined with solar. I think you're going to see blue hydrogen, relatively speaking, is going to benefit from green hydrogen being a more challenging molecule to make. And then finally, I have this dream that coming out of these regulations, we're going to see greater harmonization amongst the states and the federal requirements for making these renewable fuels. I think it's going to be really important with the federal government putting a stake in the ground as to what constitutes the green production of renewable fuels. I'm hopeful that the states look at that and say that at the least is going to satisfy whatever our criteria are for making sure that these fuels are renewables. And I am looking at you, California.
Well, I hope your dreams come true. I think we all do. In the meantime, how are you going to approach procurement, and how is that maybe different from how you thought about procurement when you were procuring for data centers?
Data centers are primarily located within the broader geographic area in order to meet the needs of their users. They need to supply those cat videos as quickly as we demand them. And so there are these strict latency requirements. And as a result, you end up solving for procurement after the data center has been sited. I think one of the exciting things about working in this industry is that we get to have a clean sheet of paper and look at the map of the US and really locate our hydrogen and clean fuel production facilities where it's most favorable to produce these fuels. And so as a result, we're focused on those areas of the country that have the greatest onshore wind complementary solar profiles, where we see the most renewable power, and we can site our facilities there.
I took you more for a dog video person than a cat video person, but no one's perfect. Okay, so are you confident that there will be enough buyers for the green fuels that you produce?
I think so. We ultimately believe that these industries, the aviation industries, maritime industries, these industries that are really hard to decarbonize, are ultimately going to have to decarbonize. Whether it's shareholders pushing them, you have international requirements, renewable fuel mandates, it's getting less and less possible for folks in these industries to throw up their hands and say, we're just not going to make progress on these climate change issues. And we also see that there are limited pathways for decarbonization. And this is reflecting itself in the conversations we have with airlines. And so we don't believe also that biofuels hold the entire answer to producing enough green fuel for allowing these industries to decarbonize. So we think there is going to be a big market for e-fuels. And we think that appetite is there for our e-jet fuel. And we're excited about fulfilling that, but these rules that IRS has come out with are really going to change how we look at the market and where we end up building our fuel production facilities.
So what about financing, Jason? Do you see challenges for securing investment for these projects now?
So I don't think that we're going to have trouble financing these facilities, but I do want Treasury to continue to refine their guidance so that we can finance them. And I think the big thing is clarity. Financiers love to look out over the at least the tenor of their financing facility and make sure that they understand exactly what those rules are going to look like and that you're going to be able to meet them. So we've been waiting 12 plus months for these regulations from Treasury. They finally have come and they leave a lot of questions unanswered. And so we really need Treasury to supply those final rules, and we need each of the minutia of those rules to be resolved so that our financiers can look at them and figure out what that financing vehicle needs to look like. I also think that we're going to need to make sure that there aren't cliff risks, as I mentioned before, where if you miss just a little bit of your hourly matching requirement, you end up losing a lot of the production tax credit. I think that's going to be really challenging for financiers to wrap their minds around and ultimately paper over.
Yeah, that makes sense. So wrapping up, Jason, are you optimistic for the future? You're an optimistic guy. What do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I am optimistic. I think of optimism as the force that, like, even while I recognize that we have these incredible challenges that we face, it pushes me to continue to dedicate my days to looking for solutions to all of these smaller challenges that we work on every day. And I think what gives me the most optimism is just that we continue to invent technologies that will enable decarbonization. So I think about the fact that lithium ion batteries, which scaled up in the 80s to meet the needs of camcorders, led ultimately to an EV revolution and now to utility scale energy storage that allows us to more efficiently produce hydrogen. So there are these unintended consequences of these technologies that we continue to invent that will ultimately, I think, allow us to remove the carbon from our economy. I think that 12's technology is going to be one of many that allows us to tackle even these really hard to decarbonize sectors. And so, yes, I'm continue to be excited to work on these issues every day and continue to be optimistic.
Good. Well, me too. And on that positive note, I'll wrap it up with that. Thank you so much, Jason, for sharing your insights. It's clear we're going to see substantial growth in the U.S. green hydrogen sector. And I think we know that there's going to be significant investment. And the pace of that growth will depend on how the industry reacts to the current tax credit rules and any further regulations that come in the months and years ahead of us. We're going to watch that with interest and share updates when we have them. And that just leaves me to say thank you again. And you can find all of our previous episodes on the DLA Piper website. And we'll be back with more very soon. So thanks again, Jason.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Please subscribe to the series at dlapiper.com/ENR or via your usual podcast platform.